That enlightened one, whose sphere is endless, whose victory is irreversible, and after whose victory no defilements remain to be conquered, by what track will you lead him astray, the trackless one? That enlightened one, in whom there is not that ensnaring, entangling craving to lead anywhere in conditioned existence, and whose sphere is endless, by what track will you lead him astray, the trackless one? So these are the first two verses of the 14th chapter of the Dhammapada. This chapter is called the Buddhavagga, or the chapter of the enlightened one. That's in Sangharakshita's translation, and it's a bringing together, the enlightened one chapter, of different verses spoken by the Buddha at different times and different places about the Buddha, about the enlightened one, about the enlightened state. And through these verses, the Buddha is communicating directly the nature of the enlightened state to his disciples. He's sharing his experience, not out of conceit or to establish his position or anything like that. He's saying these verses in order to rouse the inspiration in his disciples, to rouse their energies, because the Buddha knows that his enlightenment is not something exclusive to him. Enlightenment, Buddhahood, the state of being a Buddha, is possible for everybody. Everybody, all of us, have the potential to attain enlightenment ourselves. Enlightenment, of course, is sublime. It's a profound spiritual ideal, and very difficult to attain. And I think it's very important that we admit that we're a long, long way from fully realizing that ideal of enlightenment. But we can still, right now, live inspired and moved by that spiritual ideal. And we can transform ourselves in the light of that ideal. Right now we can change and grow in the direction of enlightenment. And that's why the Buddha image is at the centre of the shrine. It's there to move us, to inspire us, to motivate us. But in order to do that, we need to fill out as far as we can the nature of Buddhahood, the nature of enlightenment. We need to get more of a sort of feeling for it. So what I want to try and do is to get inside these verses spoken by the Buddha, which have come from the Buddha's mouth, which are the direct utterance of the enlightened mind. And let's do this with the aim of developing a deeper appreciation of enlightenment, and we're doing it to transform ourselves. So I'm just going to take, I definitely won't exhaust even these two verses. I probably won't go into every part of them, but it would take years to do that. But let's just have a go. So that enlightened one whose sphere is endless. And I remember when I first encountered this line, it was probably in way back. Probably way back when I was living at our community in Ariyatara in the 1980s. And I think we used to do these incredible meditation retreats where we do a triple meditation in the morning followed by a threefold puja. And in the threefold puja, we'd have readings from Bhante's translation of the Dhammapada, Sangharakshita's translations, which wasn't a book in those days. It was just photocopied sheets. And I remember that line, and I found it, that enlightened one whose sphere is endless. And I found it absolutely thrilling, uplifting, mysterious. That enlightened one whose sphere is endless. The Buddha occupies an endless sphere. Endless is ananta, which can also mean boundless or infinite. Boundless, infinite range, that would be another translation of this word, sphere. The term actually is gochara in Pali, quite an interesting term. Go means a cow, and chara means a place where a cow goes, so it can be translated as a pasture. That enlightened one whose pasture is infinite. But it came to mean, Gochara, something like sphere, realm, domain. It's the sphere, domain that you move in, that you occupy. We're all in some sort of Gochara, some sort of space that we occupy, that we get sort of nourishment from, that we feed on in some sort of way. We have a space in which we move. Well, the Buddha's pasture, his field, his range, his domain, his space, and what he's nourished by has no boundaries, no limitations at all. It's completely opened out. It's a space, a realm, in other words, of utter freedom. Of utter freedom. Yes, of course, he's got a physical body. That's going to confine him and limit him. He's operating in space and time, you know, in that sense. There are limitations, of course they are. But, if you like, his consciousness, if you can call it that, whatever a Buddha has absolutely no limits. You know, if you were to lock the Buddha up in a jail, he would not be limited. He would not be bounded in terms of his consciousness. So you have to kind of really imagine that kind of liberation and freedom, liberation, vimukti, mukta, vimoksha, moksha, are very famous descriptions of the enlightened state, the state of liberation. Enlightenment is a state of unbounded freedom. The unenlightened state, by contrast, is a state of restriction, of confinement, of boundedness. And we can sometimes feel this very strongly indeed. You know, even if we have all kinds of other freedoms, freedoms to spend, maybe not as much as we would like, but we don't do badly, perhaps. Freedom to travel, freedom to go on retreat, you know, freedom to move around, democratic freedoms, you know, all that sort of thing. Actually, we have an enormous amount of social freedoms in one way or another, certainly compared with some societies. But inside, we can feel terribly bounded and confined and stuck. And we can sometimes really long for a real freedom, for real liberation. Sometimes, you know, when you know, perhaps early on, before we found the Dharma, we just knew we weren't free, even though maybe everything else kind of seemed all right. And we kind of long for something that's just open. And you know, sometimes I think people can feel that their life is just, it's almost like the tracks have been set up. You know, they were set up sort of long ago, and we're just moving down them. You know, like the train just going to the end of the line. You know, and you're not going to be able to get off those tracks. Sometimes people feel this terrible feeling that you're sort of, you know, going somewhere, but actually it's not really where you want to go, but almost like I suppose this is what karma can feel like what conditioning can feel like. You're just going somewhere and you can't get off. So we can long for real freedom, for liberation, for the endless, the boundless, the boundless domain of Buddhahood, you know, where you're off the tracks, you know, where you're trackless, in a way where you're not leaving any traces, not creating any mess, because very often that feeling of boundedness, of going on those tracks, is actually because of stuff that we've done, because of decisions that we've made and things that we've done, habits that we've got into, and that's just sort of set up this repetitive life. You know, we're on a track of our creation. The Buddha is trackless. He's on no tracks. There are no paths, in a way. So the question is, how is this achieved? How is this boundless sphere attained? What do we need to do? How do we get free? And the next line makes it very clear, in principle, how such freedom, how the boundless sphere is attained. Because it says, whose victory is irreversible, and after whose victory no defilements remain to be conquered. So that enlightened one, whose sphere is endless, whose victory is irreversible, and after whose victory no defilements remain to be conquered, by what track will you lead him astray, the trackless one? So whose victory is irreversible, and after whose victory no defilements remain to be conquered. In order to attain the boundless freedom of Buddhahood, we will need to conquer, we'll need to be victorious over the defilements. Just by the way, this language of becoming of being victorious, being a conqueror, is a very big feature of Buddhism. You know, the Buddha is described as the Jinnah, the victorious one, the conqueror. And he's the conqueror over defilements. The defilements, they can be described as the asavas or the kleshas, are the inner drives, the powerful, ingrained, poisonous, negative and ignorant drives and tendencies that keep us bounded, that if you like are our boundaries, that keep us imprisoned. The crucial point in this that I want to make is that freedom, spiritual freedom, liberation is our responsibility. Nobody can give you the liberation of Buddhahood. Nobody can give you, if you like, personal freedom. Yes, it's good that you know to work for a society in which there is greater freedoms on that sort of basic, you know, human level. We need that. But in terms of, if you like, psychological and spiritual freedom and liberation, that is down to us as individuals. We have to take responsibility for that. Nobody can give it to us. The Buddha can't give it to us. It's down to us. Sometimes we can get into moods where we blame others for our lack of the feeling of freedom. Sometimes we feel it's other people who are always the oppressors. But in the end, the experience of freedom, the taste of freedom, as the Buddha calls it, the vimutti rasa, comes when we've purged the mind of those ignorant and negative drives. Sometimes we've been dealt a bad hand in life, you know, due to our circumstances. And that's really unfortunate if we've been dealt a bad hand, you know, maybe our particular early conditioning or whatever we've gone into. But in the end, it's our own individual responsibility, liberation, freedom. We have to purge our mind of those ignorant and negative drives. If we want to be free, if we want to have that boundless state, we have to conquer ourselves. As a verse, not in the chapter on the Buddha, but in the section on the thousands, a very famous verse, the Buddha says, though one should conquer in battle thousands upon thousands of men, yet he who conquers himself is truly the greatest in battle. He who conquers himself is truly the greatest in battle. And the conquering there is over the defilements. So a man who's truly stepped onto the path of the boundless liberation of the Buddha is a man who's given up blaming and sparring and battling with others to win freedom. That's really the sort of significance of this verse. You've given up trying to find freedom through battling with others, and you've started on the project of liberating, if you like, yourself from yourself. What really imprisons the man on the path, where he'll really feel that imprisoning, are the mind-forged manacles. That's in William Blake's famous phrase, the mind-forged manacles, the mind-forged bonds. Now, in the second of the two verses I quoted at the beginning, verse 180, we gain a more precise description of the root defilement that has to be conquered. That enlightened one, in whom there is not that ensnaring, entangling craving to lead anywhere in conditioned existence. That enlightened one, in whom there is not that ensnaring, entangling craving to lead anywhere in conditioned existence. So in an enlightened one, in a Buddha, there is no craving. Not a bit of it. No trishna, that's the word for craving, which literally means thirst. So imagine that, a state of no craving at all. for anything. Very hard to imagine a state of non-craving. Doesn't mean that the Buddha doesn't get hungry and he doesn't eat, doesn't get thirsty and doesn't drink, but no, if you like, emotional, existential drive, you know, to grab out and get something and pull it in. And really, when the Buddha talks like this, there is no ensnaring, entangling craving, you know, for any kind of conditioned existence. The Buddha's not, I think, talking here about specific cravings for food, sex, comfort, distractions, and so on and so forth. He's talking about something much deeper. I mean, those other things might be on top of, or expressions of that deeper thing, but he's really talking about something much, much deeper. He's talking about something existential to do with our very being, our very existence in the world. Something, you know, in a way, instinctive. And we can get more of a feeling for this if we look at the traditional Buddhist analysis of craving, the Buddha's analysis of craving. The Buddha distinguishes between three kinds of craving, which are all sort of bound up with one another. There's craving for sense experience, karma trishna, and you all know what that's like, you know, craving for chocolate, for sex, you know the kind of thing. Craving for sense experience, very important. But then there's craving for existence, or craving for being, bhava trishna. If you like, craving for fixed being, for fixed continuous existence. And then there's craving for non-existence, vibhava trishna, craving for non-being, craving for non-existence. And these last two, craving for existence and craving for non-existence, I think are of very great significance. The thing is, we don't just crave for sense experience. If it was just sense experience, I don't think craving would be so much of a problem. We'd just sort of enjoy the sense experience and we'd sort of move on. It would sort of come and go. The fact is, we go to things, to people, to situations, to our life, to find some kind of permanence and security. We want what we have to last forever, to not change. Or we go towards something with a very fixed idea of what it will give us, what we will gain from it, or them. You know, the sort of thing. And, you know, that the sort of thing, you know, you can sort of usually see it more in other people than in yourself. You see somebody moving towards a relationship or moving into a relationship, a sexual relationship, a romantic relationship, let's say, and you can sort of see all their expectations as they move into that relationship and the expectations from the other person, and you start holding your head in your hands because you just sort of know there's going to be profound disappointment. There's all these fixed ideas about the other person, about each other, and you sort of know that it's going to unravel. Like I say, it's much easier to see it in other people than in ourselves. You know, so much pain and frustration and restriction is caused by our craving for permanent being. And sometimes that's so painful, you know, because we've got it, but it hasn't turned out to be what we thought it would be, or it's changed into something else. And that can be so painful. We can crave non-existence. We try to blot out what's happening. We try to obliterate what's happening, you know, through drugs or drink or whatever it might be. Now, all of this is craving in one way or another for conditioned, fixed, bounded existence. And it runs very, very deep indeed in us. It's sort of hardwired into us. And this craving is bound up with ignorance, with avidya, with unknowing. We don't see things as they are. We don't see things as they really are. We don't see people as they really are. We don't see ourselves as we really are. And it's through seeing things as they really are that ignorance is dispelled and that ensnaring and entangling craving is dug out, is dissolved. So we need to gain some kind of feeling for what the Buddha saw. You know, if the Buddha, you know, if the Buddha's not seeing, you know, it doesn't have this craving for fixed being, a fixed existence, what is the Buddha's vision? What's his insight? What's he seeing? How has that, what's he seeing, and how has that, how has he come to have dispelled that craving? There's another ancient Pali collection, early Buddhist collection of texts called the Udana, the verses of inspiration or the verses of uplift. And the first three sections in that collection are very short, very pithy little suttas, as they're called, discourses. And these very short texts describe the Buddha's vision, which brings about his nirvana, his enlightenment. And it describes it in terms of in seeing, and here's a clunky phrase for you, conditioned co-production, praticca samutpada, or dependent origination. And the Buddha describes what he's seeing in using a formula. It can sound a bit almost scientific, this formula, but just hear it, just listen to it, and see if it does anything for you. Sometimes, you know, in the tradition, you know, some disciples, when they heard this formula, immediately gained stream entry, irreversibility from enlightenment on hearing it. Admittedly, it was the Buddha or one of his disciples saying it. But I'm going to read it and just see what happens. You never know. I'll try and put on a Buddha voice. This being, that becomes. On the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not become. On the ceasing of this, that ceases. Like I say, it sounds like a scientific formula. It sounds rather heady, rather prosaic. But what this little formula encapsulates is the Buddha's vision, in fact, of the whole of existence, of the whole of life. And the essence of this vision is that there is nothing anywhere that is fixed, permanent, and unchanging. There is nowhere any kind of substance or permanence or self, whether it be an individual, an empire, a cosmos. There is just this continual arising and ceasing. Arising of a flow of conditions, giving a rise to further conditions, and at the same time, a ceasing, a passing away of certain other conditions. There is just a kind of emergence and passing, an emergence and passing. And this is happening all the time, everywhere. I mean, it's fantastic this time of year. I mean, early in the morning, I usually go out to have a good look at the roses. Roses are really interesting because when they're at their full bloom, you know, you think, oh, wow, they're really at their peak of sort of development. They're already fading. They're already ceasing. They're already passing out of being. There's just this arising and ceasing. It's emergence and passing away. Everything is like that all the time, including ourselves. Look upon the world as a bubble. Look upon it as a mirage. The king of death does not see one who looks upon the world in this way. This is the Buddha in the Dhammapada, the section on the world. Look upon the world as a bubble, arising and passing very quickly. Look upon it as a mirage. There's nothing substantial in it. The king of death does not see one who looks upon the world in this way. The king of death does not see one. And you can interpret that in any number of ways. But if you like, the king of the death of the spiritual life, the death of a creative life, doesn't see somebody, doesn't touch somebody, doesn't get hold of somebody who sees life in this dynamic way. So the problem with craving for being is that we're attempting to fix, to make permanent, to make secure what is essentially changing, what is essentially always transforming. And craving for not being is futile as well, because experience, life, just can't go away. You can't make it nothing. That's impossible. You can't just blot it all out into nothing. Because as well as passing away, there is a rising. There's passing away, there's a rising. There's a rising, there's passing away. And a Buddha always sees this. The Buddha is always in touch with this constant arising and passing and arising. If you like, he doesn't just see it, as it were, from a distance as an idea. You could say he's fully harmonized with this. He's wise to this. So he's utterly free. He's utterly liberated. Free to act in the most creative way. And happy. Blissful. We mustn't forget this. It's said in the Dhammapada, it says, Nirvanam Paramam Sukham. Nirvana is the supreme bliss. Nirvanam Paramam Sukham. Nirvana is the supreme bliss. And it's said in that old text, the Udana, that on seeing the truth of Pratityasamutpada, this vast becoming, this arising and passing, the Buddha spent 7 days, periods of 7 days. I think if you totted them all up, it'd probably be about 49 days, something like that. 7, 49, magic numbers. So we're really talking about a timeless state beyond, well, the boundless state, if you like, where time is transcended. It's the eternal, the timeless. But it's said that he enjoyed the bliss of liberation, the sukha vimoksha, the bliss of liberation, out of time, in the boundless, endless sphere, just enjoying without any kind of attachment, great bliss, great happiness. And you're way beyond, even the language of experience here doesn't apply, because experience implies someone experience and something to be experienced. Well, the Buddha's way, way out beyond all that kind of stuff. I mean, he's beyond language, so it's a happiness, a bliss beyond all language. So it's a very inspiring picture indeed of him in the depths of the forest, in his rag robes. Sangharakshita, in his commentary on the Udana, he likens the Buddha to being like a sort of shaman who's gone right out. You know, the shaman goes away from the tribe, goes into the jungle to undergoes all sorts of experiences which, if you like, just for him, as it were, unique, in order to come back to the tribe to show them the way. And he says perhaps the Buddha is something like this. He's there, away in the jungle, enjoying the bliss, the ecstasy of liberation from all bounds, from all bonds, from craving, from ignorance, as well as their derivatives, hatred, fear, conceit, confusion, jealousy. They've all gone. Whoever in the world overcomes this wretched adhesive craving, so difficult to overcome, his sorrows fall from him like drops of water from a lotus leaf. Whoever in this world overcomes this wretched adhesive craving, so difficult to overcome, his sorrows fall from him like drops of water from a lotus leaf. That's for verse 336 in the Dhammapada. You'll get the verses after the talk. So you notice too, going back to the verse about the Buddha's victory, that the Buddha's victory over the defilements is described as irreversible. It's an irreversible victory. The Buddha's attainment of victory over the defilements, his freedom, can't be turned back. He can't be conquered. We might have our moments when we see the bubble-like nature of life, the arising and passing, the insubstantiality of things. We might have our moments of spiritual liberation. But all too quickly, our craving to fix ourselves and our experience reasserts itself. It conquers us. It might even be about that experience of freedom. You know, you sometimes see this with people who've had, they can have a meditation experience or something like that, and it becomes a badge. They become like the ancient mariner who keeps sort of stopping you. I've had this experience. And they want to tell you all about it. But of course, good though that experience is, it's gone. It arises and passes. If it does have real meaning and value, you don't need to talk about it. You don't even need to think about it. It will be a part of things. But the Buddha is irreversibly moving in that endless and boundless sphere. Enlightenment then is endless. So we shouldn't think of the Buddha's enlightenment as some fixed point. You know, that you go along, you get enlightenment, and then you just put your feet up in some sort of enlightenment holiday camp. You know, where nothing else sort of happens. Well, you've sort of done it now, so, you know, what do you do then? You sort of watch telly and sit by the pool and so on. But Sangharakshita's pointed out that enlightenment is a sort of horizon. It's something that we, in a way, we need, if you like, to aim for. But we should never think of that as a fixed goal. If you like, the transformations go on, but the transformations are utterly inconceivable to us. The Buddha's activity, his creativity, goes on. And in particular, the creative activity in relation to the liberation of others. The compassionate activity, the Buddha activity, as they call it, is natural, spontaneous, compassionate activity to liberate others. Now, of course, the banishing of unknowing, of ignorance, and the uprooting of craving is no easy thing. And it's not achieved through some trick of the mind, some mental technique. As the Buddha says, craving is difficult to overcome. So it's important not to be disappointed if we feel that we are failing sometimes, or we're really up against it. The overcoming of craving involves nothing less than the total transformation of our being. Nothing less. That's why Sangharakshita speaks about the stages of the path as, later stages of the path as, spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. It's a transformation. Transformation involves spiritual death, spiritual rebirth. So, you know, we shouldn't be, don't get disappointed if, you know, you're finding it a bit of a struggle sometimes. This also means that we'll need to cultivate a powerful aspiration, a very deep longing, even paradoxically a desire, a very strong desire to attain enlightenment, which means becoming deeply moved by the inspiration and the example of the Buddha himself. The Buddha described his own quest and search for enlightenment as the Arya Pariyasana. The Arya Pariyasana, which has been translated as the noble quest or the noble search. Arya meaning noble or saintly, or really standing for nirvana, enlightenment, the transcendent. But Pariyasana means more than quest and search. It means intensely desiring. Intensely desiring. It signifies a strong, deep and intensely emotionally motivated search for the state that is beyond suffering, beyond craving, the deathless, as the Buddha mysteriously calls it, the amata dhatu, the deathless realm. And a verse from another chapter in the Dhammapada describes what is needed. He is called one whose stream goes upward, in whom is born an ardent aspiration after the undefined nirvana, whose mind would be permeated by the thrill of his progress so far, and whose heart is unattached to sensual pleasures. So this verse is evoking the total commitment to the attainment of the endless sphere, to the total commitment to the bliss of liberation, to Buddhahood. And in a seminar on the Udana, Sangha actually tries to evoke what had been involved in the Buddha's search for enlightenment, for liberation. And he's commenting on that, I mentioned that long period that the Buddha spent in meditation, in the bliss of liberation after his enlightenment. And this is what he says. One can be sure that there was a tremendous period of inner absorption for a very long period of time after the Buddha saw things as they really are. After all, the Buddha had gained enlightenment, which he'd been looking for so many years, and at last he was there. So all his energy poured into that, just like a waterfall falling from a tremendous height. Everything goes over. There's nothing left behind. Everything goes over. There's nothing left behind. So if we're serious about the Dharma, about the spiritual life, and if we want to enjoy that thrill of progress that the Dhammapada verse spoke about, everything, all of our energy will need to be gathered and channeled to go over the edge to boundless freedom. And of course, that's not the work of a day or of a short retreat. It's not even the work of a few years. It's for us, it will be a gradual path sustained over the course of our whole life, over perhaps many lives. And another Dhammapada verse: do not underestimate good, thinking it will not approach me. A water pot becomes full by the constant falling of drops of water. Similarly, the wise man, little by little, fills himself with good. So it's a gradual transformation, a gradual path. And of course, the Buddha, after his enlightenment, taught a gradual, a progressive path that leads to liberation. And tomorrow we'll begin to look at the very first things that we need to do to enter that gradual path.